We talked about, this is funny, we talked about her least favorite quote tonight, her least favorite quote from AA, and that's, how's that working for you? And from last week, I thought the speaker said that might have been his favorite quote, how's that working for you? And so just how things work in different magical ways in this program. But could we please give a warm Valley Group welcome for Zochi?
Yay, thank you. How fun to have an intro. I've never had that before, so that was kind of cool. And just thank you for everybody that brought me here tonight. Thank you for everybody who showed up tonight to listen to me instead of going to the Pacific Group, which is a regular Wednesday night meeting. So here I am, though. And just thank you for inviting me during this lovely Zoom presentation where my the mileage on my car is a whole lot smaller coming tonight than it would have been otherwise. Not to say that I wouldn't have driven. I would have. I've done it before. I came up with my bestie. So, but yeah, definitely. Thank you for being so hospitable and everybody just being so kind and letting me know what it was that I had to expect. And this is just a great group. So it's been a great start. So we're just going to get into, you know, the regular format, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, or, you know, what I acted like, what happened, and what I act like now, or what I felt like, what happened, and what I felt like, what I feel like now, and most importantly, the way that I used to think, what happened and how I think now, because, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was instrumental in getting rid of my drinking problem. And it continues on a daily basis for over 21 years to help me with my thinking problem. As my sponsor likes to tell me over and over again, I will never be more physically sober than I was at 6 months of sobriety. Like, my physical body is as physically sober as it was ever going to get. But my drinking problem did not go away after 6 months because I have a thinking problem. So, my name is Zochi, and I'm an alcoholic. As you can see, my name is spelled X-O-C-H-I-T-L. It is Aztec Indian. It means flower. And it also means that I was branded as terminally unique from the moment I was born. It is the first thing that I remember feeling absolutely uncomfortable about. I would have to either explain how to say it, or explain how to spell it, or explain why my white girl persona had this really funky name. Parents born in the 60s, and my mom is a Mexican, so there you have it. But it is the very first thing that I remember feeling different than everybody else. Like I said, my mom is Mexican, my dad's Scottish. When I was 8 years old, they had this knockdown, drag-out fight called a divorce. And what this meant was that dad left, and mom went back to work full-time. And I have a little brother who's 2 years younger than me, so I became a part-time mom. I was only supposed to be mom when my mom wasn't home, and when she got home, I was supposed to stop doing that. When my I was the messenger between my parents, because whatever my dad did to my mom, she hated him, and so I would have to be the person who would give the messages back and forth between my parents. And when my mom was really angry at me, she would tell me that I was just like my father. And since I knew she hated my father, I was convinced that she hated me too. And I just remember feeling like that was the first time that things just went absolutely sideways and wrong. I mean, before that, I just think that I had a perfect childhood. And then all of a sudden, this divorce thing happens, and like my whole world fell apart. And for me, my very first drug of choice before all others has been sugar. So I would lie, beg, borrow, cheat, and steal to get your candy. I would eat your candy and help you look for it. I was that kind of a sugar addict. And like, when there was not enough sugar in the house, I learned how to bake so that I could make my own sugar. I would hide the ice cream way behind the disgusting food in the freezer so that my brother wouldn't get to it. Like, I was all about sugar. And my second drug of choice was absolute full-flight fantasy. Like, I loved any story that ended with happily ever after. I loved Disney movies. I loved musicals. I just loved to read. Like, I loved to just be out of, not be in my body, not be in my life, just to be, my imagination would take me outside to somewhere else that I didn't want to be where I was. And that was my coping mechanism for many, many years. You know, I went to a private Catholic school, and when my parents got divorced was the first time that I realized that, like, we didn't have the same economic security that other people at the school did. And the way that really manifested for me was that when we would have days where we didn't wear our uniform, people would show up in these really cool clothes that were, like, you know, designer fashion week. And I didn't have that, and I would go home and ask for that. And the things that my mom would do is she would, you know, probably age myself here, but, you know, my mom would get me the Le Tigre shirt with the tiger on the wrong side, where everybody else was wearing the Izod shirt with the alligator on the other side. Like, you could see that it was the knockoff. It was not the actual, you know, like, Kinney shoes, not Vans. Like, you knew that these were the cheap version of what everybody else was wearing. So my answer to that was to forget that it was free dress and just go to school in my uniform. What I wanted to do was just, like, blend in. I did whatever I could to stay at school so I didn't have to deal with what was going on at home. So I'd do all the before school and after school activities, even if they made me uncomfortable. It was better than being at home, and that's how I coped with things. I was a chameleon. I wasn't, like, friends with any one group. I just wanted to be friends with everybody because I didn't want to, like, make anybody upset with me. So I just tried to stay friends with everybody, and I didn't want my mom or dad to get mad at me at any point. So I was a super, super good student, like teacher's pet good student, like valedictorian in the eighth grade good student. Like, that's how I coped with my days at school. And so what happened for me was I went to an all-girl Catholic high school. Me and my best friend went to this all-girl Catholic high school. And there weren't very many boys in the Catholic junior school that we went to be honest. Like, I think the most boys we ever had in our class was, like, five. But now we were in an all-girl school, my bestie and I, and we decided that we wanted to know what it was like to go to school with boys. So we would sneak off of the campus and then, like, jump on the bus and then sneak onto the campus at Beverly Hills High School because there were truant officers in the neighborhood, so we'd have to sneak onto the campus. And then we'd go to school at this public school while our parents were paying these huge amounts of tuition for us to go to private school, which was really awesome. And for me, being the kid that just wanted to blend in and fit in and not get in trouble, and I had horrible, horrible amounts of guilt, for me, like, I had had alcohol before. Like, I had alcohol, like, when we had, like, fancy dinners or parties, and we'd have a sip of wine, and I remember my legs feeling a little, you know, bendy, and then falling asleep really early, and it didn't seem like that big of a deal to me to drink. But what I do remember is that at this point, when we were doing this sneaking around and forging notes to the teachers, that, like, what it took for me to do those things, to lie and to get away with it and to not feel bad and to talk to boys on a public school campus and lie to teachers and a public school system, it took alcohol for me. It became a tool for me. It was something that I needed to do in order to get through those things. And I realized that really early on, that it became something that helped me through things and helped me to live life like what it looked like everybody else knew how to do. And eventually, like, my best friend and I, we got into tons of trouble for ditching school all the time. The funny thing was that she would always get caught for the forgeries because she, I guess, didn't have as good of handwriting as I did. And I never got caught for the forgeries. My mom, you know, she liked to drink a little bit, too. So I think she would forget that I was not absent on that day. So I kind of lucked out, but my best friend did not have such a good experience. So she got into more and more trouble, but I continued to hang out with her because she's my best friend. And, you know, I did a lot of drinking. And what I remember is they talk about how you some people, I, you know, crossed an invisible line from, you know, just having fun and drinking into alcoholism. For me, my line was not invisible. It was white. It was on the back of a cassette case. It was handed to me by a boy, went up my nose, and changed my world forever. I was no longer passing out, and I could drink you under the table. I remembered what was going on, and it was like this miracle for me. And what it did for me was that it made me stop liking the rules at my mom's house, so I went to go live with my dad. And then I stopped liking the rules at my dad's house, and I became a teenage runaway at the age of 16. And what that looked like for me was I had a full-time job at a cookie place at the mall. And I would go to work at the cookie place and make money, and then I would go and buy, you know, outside issues and alcohol in order to find a place, a couch to stay on that my parents wouldn't find me from night to night. They would just know where I was when I was working. And that worked out really, really well for me. I didn't have much overhead, so that was good. And what ended up happening is that I made this conscious decision, like, I was going to show my parents what it was like to love a child unconditionally, because, you know, they really had it wrong, and I was going to teach them. And so I found a guy at the Square Pan Pizza place next door, and we went off and had a baby. And what that looked like for me was that I thought, oh, God, we got to get away from all the drugs and the alcohol and the people we lived around, so we should move out of town, and it would be safer for us to, you know, do that. So we moved up to Humboldt, because that was the good place to go when you're having a baby, apparently. And up there, it was a very depressed area. You were either a student or a retired person. I was neither one of those things. And also, when this baby came, I did not have the appendix at the end of the happily ever after story with the guidebook on how to be a mom. Like, I didn't have any direction whatsoever. I was completely clueless, so desperate. We moved back down to his mom's house. And we got into the same group of people and started doing the same stuff. And what that meant for me was that, you know, I thought, oh, gosh, you know, the good Catholic girl that I am, I really should put a Band-Aid on this, and we should get married. We should get married, and we should move away with the money that we get from getting married. So we did that, and then we moved up to a place called Lancaster in California. And if you've never been to Lancaster in California, they have this, it's the Antelope Valley, and they have this lookout area as you drive into the valley, and it's really cool at night, like around midnight, either on the 1st or the 15th when the welfare checks come out. Every single light in the entire Antelope Valley will be on. They'll stay on for about 4 or 5 days. And then they'll start to dim out a little bit, and they'll come back on when the welfare checks come out again, because that's when we get our money, and that's when we go to the dealer, and that's how we stay up all night. And that's how my life was when we got to Lancaster. And I had this new husband, and I had this baby, and I couldn't figure out why this new husband wasn't working. He couldn't find a job, and I came home one night, and I found him in bed with a 16-year-old babysitter. And again, my entire life fell out from underneath me, and he ran off, and I became this single mom who was, you know, I would go to work from 4 to 10 as a waitress at a square, where was I? A cafe. I worked at a cafe. And then from 10 until about 2 in the morning, I would work as a cocktail waitress. And then I would get home and I would do the dishes and the laundry and, you know, rearrange the cupboards and rewire the vacuum cleaner and be awake when my daughter got up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I thought that was fantastic. Like, I had a chemical composition going on in my body that was working. What I like to call myself was Wonder Woman. Like, I'm Wonder Woman. I used to love the description of myself as being fiercely independent. Like, that was a badge of honor for me. And what happens is that I can't stay in that area, because that area is what's making my life fall apart. And so we have to move down to South Orange County. At this point, my daughter's old enough to go to preschool, and I can get a 9-to-5 job. And so I went to work at a mortgage company. And when you work at a mortgage company, at 5 o'clock, everybody goes to happy hour. So of course I had to do that. And if I'm playing quarters in the conference room with my boss at midnight, then when I'm, you know, forced to answer the phone while lying on the floor hungover in the morning and still getting a paycheck, that's my functioning alcoholism. And I don't see anything wrong with that as long as I'm paying my rent and I still have a job, right? And it just continues to get worse and worse. But what happens is, you know, I always have to have a hostage, I mean, a boyfriend. And what happens is that they don't seem to stay on that same level as me. Somehow they become better than and look down their nose at how much I'm drinking and putting it into my system. And I have to replace them in order to not feel horrible about myself, because what do they know? So the next guy that I found, he was the Disney, you know, Prince Charming, and he came in with the limousine and the roses and swept me off my feet, and we were just going to be together forever. And he and I moved in together, and, you know, we went and we backpacked Europe, and about 5 years into it, I came home and he told me to take my child and get the fuck out. And this is the third time that my entire, like, the booby trap door just fell out from underneath me. And mind you, there's not been one moment in any of this, of my life career, that I've taken a moment to stop and feel these feelings or work through them or see where things could be better for me. Like, I just fall entirely apart. Like, I just lose my mind. And what I do is I pour more alcohol, and I pour more alcohol inside of me, trying to not feel those feelings, because, you know, my life is falling apart. And I stop thinking that I'm worth it anymore. I stop thinking that I deserve to be around in this world, like that I'm necessary to anybody else in this world, right? And I start to get these suicidal tendencies. First, though, I got to find myself a lore companion, which I did. He had just gotten out of prison. And we moved in with him to this apartment. And a few days later, he was rearrested for whatever it was that he did before. And I stopped wanting to take my 11-year-old daughter to school anymore, because it was getting in the way of me, you know, waking up that early was really getting in the way of my drinking and using. Working was way too difficult. I had to stop doing that. That was getting in the way of my drinking and using. I felt bad about stopping taking my daughter to school, though, so I thought I'd get her a puppy. That'd make it better. But we lived in a place that didn't allow dogs, so we were evicted. We're driving around in this guy's pickup truck who actually did get let back out of prison, so I had to give him back his pickup truck, but we've been driving around in his pickup truck with a beanbag for a bed in the back for about a week, driving around and screaming, singing at the top of our lungs, because I just idolized Janis Joplin. I just wanted to live hard and die young. And so my daughter and I would run around, we'd sing, "Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz," at the top of our lungs, a cappella, all over the place with the dog and the truck. And there was this night, and before that happened, as I was going to give, and part of the reason that I thought that I just really didn't need to try any longer is that I had lost so much weight that I had gone to put on my deodorant, and I looked in the mirror when I raised my arm up, and I saw that there was a lump about the size of a shooter marble in one of my breasts, and I made the conscious decision, did I want to take my money and give it to a doctor or give it to a dealer? Did I want to stay drunk or did I want to get healthy? I wanted to stay drunk. That was more fun. That was more worth it. I didn't have plans to live past the age of 30, so I'm fine anyways. And so I just kept going with what I was doing. And I can tell you that I don't know where my daughter was on this night. I was not the mom that was exchanging phone numbers and calling to check up to see how my kid was. I just know that she was at a play date somewhere. And I was off doing what it was that I needed to do to make money, which was to spend money or write my own bad checks. I would write checks at a store, and then I would change the date on the receipt and go return it at a different store for cash. And this guy wanted this truck back, and there was this bottle of stuff in the car that was for the care of the dog, and it had a skull and crossbones on it, and I decided to drink that and chase it down with a bottle of Malibu rum because I was done. And I went to go give him his truck back, and we were driving down to some motel where I was going to spend my last night. And I got really dizzy, and I pulled over, and I said I needed for him to drive. And about 5 minutes later, we were pulled over by the police. And because he was under this thing called search and seizure, we had to get out of the car and I passed out. And when I woke up, I was in the hospital and I had had my stomach pumped. And they wanted to, you know, have some answers to some questions about these checks and this merchandise that I had purchased. And, you know, they had impounded the truck and they had impounded the car and they had impounded the parolee. And they wanted me to answer questions that I didn't want to give them. And so they gave me a pretty pair of silver bracelets and took me down to South Orange County Women's Jail, where I got to spend the weekend. And I got to spend the weekend in a special part where you were all by yourself, called the 5150 ward, because I was cuckoo. And I didn't sleep the entire time that I was there because there was another woman in another room that didn't sleep the entire time. And I will never forget, for 72 hours, she never stopped saying, "Yes, yar, hey, pig. Yes, yar, hey, pig. Yes, yar, hey, pig." And if I wasn't crazy when I got there, by the Monday morning when they took me out of there, I was absolutely nuts. And what I remember happening in those, you know, 24 hours or 48 hours from that weekend, what I remember happening was that I had not been sober for that many hours in a row for a really long time. And what I remember doing was feeling desperate and realizing, oh my God, what would my 11-year-old daughter's life have looked like if she knew that her mom had committed suicide? And oh my God, all I could think of was all of those, you know, prayers that I learned in my Catholic upbringing. And I just prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed. And, you know, I was the girl that was like, "God, why are you doing this to me? God, why can't you help me? God, why, you know, give me what I need. God, show up for me." You know, I was just begging for help at that point. I did that, "God, you've got to help get me out of this." And they would bring me food, and I was so, like, out of it that I would drop the food on the ground, and they would bring me a mop, and I'd have to clean it up. So when I got to the courthouse on Monday morning, they were going to release me of my own recognizance because they'd never caught me for anything else. And so I was ready to go, but then my mom stood up from the back of this courtroom and said, "But wait." And that meant they got to keep me for another 72 hours, which really, I mean, I hated my mom, and that did not help matters at all. And at the end of that 72 hours, I wasn't allowed to leave unless somebody picked me up, and my mom was the only one that would come and get me. And so I reluctantly went to my mother's house. And at this point, like, I knew there was something wrong with me, you know? There had to be an answer, and I went to the place that I know has all the answers. I got on the internet and I looked on Google to find out what was wrong with me, you know, because I had to have some, like, there had to be some doctor or some pill or a shot or a, you know, some program, something that's to fix me, because I knew that I was broken. Like, I was really, really broken. And what my mom did was she took me, she had a coworker who told her to take me to a place called the Claire Foundation, which is a place in Santa Monica. And she took me there, and these guys took me into an office, and they started to ask me questions off of the checklist, like, how old are you when you started drinking? How, you know, have you ever used this drug? Have you ever used that drug? And, you know, every molecule in my being wanted to say, "You don't know what you're talking about. I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I never do those things. That's horrible." But it was almost as if some other voice was coming out of me, and it was telling the truth, and it was admitting to these things. And the physical reaction in my body, I remember living with this boulder that lived between my shoulders, just this anxiety and fear and depression, and it just started to fall off just a tiny bit. And they asked, you know, "Can you stay? Can you stay? We have a bed for you." And I said, "Whoa, but wait, I have all this really super important stuff. I need to go put it into storage. I'll be right back. Just let me go get my stuff in storage, and I'll come back, and I'll take that bed." And I went back to my brother's apartment where I had been staying, and I proceeded to call every single person, every prior coworker, every, you know, distant cousin, anybody that I could think of that I knew. And in the course of about 20 minutes, it was the darkest and loneliest I'd ever felt in my life. There was not one person that wanted anything to do with me anymore. And what I do when I'm freaking out is that I clean, and I'm drinking my brother's Coors Light, and I'm washing the dishes, and the water's running, and I feel like I need to use the restroom, and I don't make it to the bathroom, and I pee all over myself, and it's that one last time of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Got in the shower, got myself back to Claire Foundation, and said, "Please help me. Please take me." And that was the beginning of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to tell you, I've always been told to be really careful how you pray. The girl that was, you know, there for, you know, an hour before me, so she was going to show me what it was like to live at the Claire Foundation, her name was Mercedes, and she had a sister named Portia. And you can't make that shit up. Like, I had been praying with my daughter at the top of my lungs in the car for Mercedes, and here she was. And we proceeded to do 120 meetings in 30 days. And that's what that looked like for me, was, you know, having somebody else kind of walk me through it. I needed a buddy. I was terrified, you know, and being at the Claire Foundation was really similar to being homeless indoors. It was not the establishment that it is today. And what I remember was three important things happened to me while I was in that detox. And the first one was is that there was a girl that came in and she told my story. She had been neglectful to her child. She had written the bad checks and returned the merchandise. She had 6 months of sobriety. And I could buy that because I was able to stay sober for the length of time that I found out I was pregnant. So I thought, okay, you could probably stay sober for 6 months. I didn't believe time passed that. Like, I didn't believe that was a possibility. But I could believe that 6 months. And she had the five things that I wanted AA to give me back, right? Which was like, I wanted an apartment, I wanted my car back, I wanted my kid back, I wanted a job, and I wanted a pager. And if AA could give me those five things, like if I could get that back on my repertoire, then I would be okay again, you know? And so I started to have a little bit of hope. The second thing that happened was that we used to have to wait along the wall and before we go in and eat, and there was the Footprints in the Sand poem framed on the wall there, and I remember reading it. And I started to think of all the times that I put myself in some really bad situations, not just the time where I drank the skull and crossbones, but like a lot of places and a lot of things that I did that were really super dangerous and really super stupid, and how did I survive those things? Because it wasn't my will. Like, I didn't want to be here anymore. I would rather be dead. Like, honestly, I'd rather be dead. And so I started to believe that maybe there was something that carried me through it, and maybe there was a reason that I was still here, and maybe if there was this God that could maybe forgive me, then maybe I could start to forgive myself. And the third thing that happened while I was there at the Claire Foundation was that I came running out to tell the girls, oh my God, did you know that my eyes are like brown in the inside and then they're kind of green on the outside? Did you know that? And they're like, yeah, duh, your eyes are hazel. Anyways. And I knew that. Like, I wrote it on my driver's license, you know, application. Like, I knew my eyes were hazel. But I can tell you that I hadn't looked myself in the eyes, like, really to see the color of my eyes since maybe 12 years old, you know? And you can be sure I hadn't looked anybody else in the eyes, because when I looked other people in the eyes, like, I would have to see all of the disappointment, I would have to feel all of the shame that I would feel, you know, having lied to them and having disappointed them. And I couldn't look at people anymore. And for some reason, after being at Claire for this 30 days, I was able to look other people in the eyes and recognize the fact that I was looking myself in the eyes again. And so, you know, I was the girl that, like, you know, skipped out the front door on a rainbow into a cloud mobile, and I was just, everything was going to be great. Like, I was going to get all my stuff back, and it was going to be fantastic. And that's not how it happened. You know, that's not what God wanted for me. The first thing I did do, though, was that they took us to outside meetings. So the first thing I did was I just kept going back to those meetings that they took us to. And the first meeting I went into, there was this lady, and she was talking, and I don't remember a lot about what she said, but I knew that her name started with a Q, and my name starts with an X. So she had to understand the misery of my entire life. So she had to be my sponsor. Like, that was my requirement for a sponsor right there. That's it. End all. Be all. And she asked me if I was willing to do anything to be sober. And, you know, what I realized was that I was willing to do anything to get what these other people had, this joy, this, you know, reaching out and hugging and loving each other and the laughter and the happiness and their lives weren't falling apart anymore. They were starting to get better. And, like, yeah, I was willing to do anything it took to have that. And so I started to work the steps with the desperation of the dying, you know, and I worked them to the best of my ability. The first thing that I have to say that, like, the most difficult part of the beginning of my sobriety was living without my daughter. Like, I had been a bad mom, especially during the last 3 years of my drinking and using. But suddenly living without her was like living without my right arm, and I didn't know how to do that. And I had a sponsor who told me that she was exactly where she needed to be, and I was exactly where I needed to be, because there's only one God. God doesn't have grandchildren. She has a God, and I have a God. It's the same person. I don't get to be in between that. And so I recognized that, and I started to do things that would kind of help me, you know, get past that. Like, I was able to get the dog out of impound, and when I got the dog out of impound, I started taking the dog to doggy daycare in the morning, and then I would pick the dog up from doggy daycare after a job, you know, and it was like, you know, having what doing what I had done with my daughter just to kind of limp by there. And when my daughter called, I answered. When my daughter needed something, I provided it. When my daughter needed me, I was there for her. And we started to develop this relationship where she could depend on me. And we started to develop a relationship where she saw me getting better. You know, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I, you know, went to a temp agency. And the third place that they took me to was a place called the John Wayne Cancer Institute. And I started to work there, and, you know, I just started to do exactly what I had learned to do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, as, you know, the chip chick and the treasurer and the literature person and the secretary and the chair setter upper. Like, I just did all those things as a job. You taught me to be a worker among workers, and that's all I wanted to be. I just was the best that I could be at this place. And I confided in one person about this funky lump that I had, and she told the director, and they just hired me on full time almost right away, and they put me on their insurance, and they took me to their doctor, and they removed that lump, and I was cancer free. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to lay underneath the covers and pretend that wasn't there anymore. Like, I had gained a bunch of weight in Claire Foundation, so you didn't see that lump anymore. But, you know, to be, you know, God took care of things that I couldn't take care of on a regular basis, just from walking through what my sponsor and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do. I made Alcoholics Anonymous the center of my life. That was what I did 24 hours a day. And I remember when I remember seeing the steps on the wall and seeing step 9 and thinking, you know what, I'm going to skip that one. Nobody will notice. I'm a really good student. So, you know, I could just skip right by that. I could play it off. And so when I got there, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to let God decide what my first 9-step amend should be. And next morning, the cops are at my door rearresting me for what it was I was arrested for to begin with, because, you know, they have that option if they feel like it. And so I ended up, like, being rearrested and going, you know, as they were moving me from cell to cell to get me to wherever it was they were going to take me, I would hit my knees and just pray to God, oh my God, you know, just take care of me. Just, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Just take care of me. And my dad, who didn't live anywhere in California, happened to be in town that day. And he happened to have a college roommate who was a criminal attorney. And they were able to get me out, and they were able to get me an ankle bracelet to be on house arrest in order to pay off and make restitution to the Bank of America for all of those fraudulent checks that I had written. That was really, like, on the lowest part of the list of amends that I planned on making. But, you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I don't even know how that worked out for me. But what I do know is that what happened when I went to go drive down to the probation officer, because it was in South Orange County, and I was driving down there, and I remember somebody, like, honking like a maniac on the freeway, trying to get my attention. They wanted to you know, talk to me, and I drove in a Jeep, so, like, it was really a heck of a thing to unzip the window in order to, like, be able to talk to somebody through the window. So, and I was not in the mood to, like, flirt with anybody, but I unzipped the damn window, like, what? And they're like, oh, I noticed that you have that, you know, circle with the triangle sticker on the back of your car, and I'm a friend of Bill, and wherever you're going, everything's going to be okay. Like, what? What? Okay, so, like, I remembered maybe I should tell this probation officer that I need to be able to get to meetings. How do I do that? And, oh, she was so excited about this, because then they were going to give me this device that I had to hook up to my telephone. They would call me randomly, and I have to blow into it and, like, be sure not to brush your teeth or have curry. And I was just terrified. I mean, I lived with this ankle bracelet for about a year, going back and forth to work with nobody knowing about it except for one person. I would run back and forth to meetings at night, and I was a smoker who wasn't allowed to smoke in my apartment building, so I would sit there with my leg inside the door with it closed on my leg and smoke outside of the door and wave to the neighbors. You know, it was just a joy, like, because I was so terrified of getting into trouble, and I walked through that entire thing. And on my 2-year AA birthday is when that ankle bracelet was removed from me. Like, how crazy is that? You know, another thing that happened that, you know, I think of these things that it's not odd, it's God. Like, my God is loud. When I got my car back, like, the first thing I did was not to go out and get a job. Like, I was going to do what AA people do, and I was going to help people get rides to meetings. Okay, the guys sober living, they all needed rides to meetings. I mean, I was a newcomer, so, like, you know, I had my, yeah, but I was being of service. I was being of service, you know, and this night I was 29 going on 30, and the car broke down, and I thought, you know, I've got this ID, and I could probably get really wasted for one more night. I could just go back out there and drink again, you know. I have plans, and since my car broke down, I should just go out and do that, because I'm looking cute tonight. And before my foot could hit the ground, a bunch of guys that were on the corner pushed my car out of the way. I'm like, great, good, and I can just leave it here. Went to go get out of the car again, and a tow truck driver pulled up behind me, and he came, and he did whatever he needed to do to my car, and he looked at me, and he said these words. He said, okay, so get back to wherever it was you were going. Really? Last night that I, like, had plans to go out and get wasted, and I turned 30, didn't have a plan in the world to stay alive for that long. So every moment that has happened from that moment to this moment has been the grace of God. 100%. It has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with alcoholism. You know, you taught me to be a worker among workers. You taught me to be a good mother. You taught me to be a good sponsee and a good sponsor as a requirement of being a good sponsee. You taught me the tools that I needed to have to learn how to live, which I did not know how to do before I got here. And it wasn't about getting physically sober anymore. It was about getting emotionally sober. It was about getting, you know, responsible in my life. And those are things that I didn't want anything to do with. But I saw that if I worked the steps, that those things just were a benefit of those steps, you know. And I saw that, you know, there wasn't anything that I'd ever done or experienced in AA that somebody else hadn't done or experienced. There was always somebody else that I could go to, you know. And there's been so many times where my ass has fallen in this place where I just needed desperately direction, you know. And then there were so many times where there was just causes for celebration and wonder, you know. I've been all over the world with AA there. Like, who knew? Like, even, like, in places like Bali, where beer is 65 cents, they have a huge sober community. They do know when beer is 65 cents. I don't know, but they do. You know, I've been to places where I didn't even speak the language, but when I start to hear Chapter 5 being read, like, just the way that it's said makes me feel like I'm at home. Like, I can go anywhere in the world and not know anyone, but know that these people are part of my tribe, you know, that they understand where it is that I come from, and that I need to be in a meeting with Alcoholics Anonymous to be a normal person, like, whatever normal is. And then, you know, one of the other things is that I have a sponsor who collects sponsees, like, literally. Like, I have 20 sponsor brothers and sisters at least at any given time. It's the same person, the Q, just so you know. So she just loves to collect sponsees. And there was a point in my life where I remarried, because I had the same interview process as I did with the pizza guy, but in the rooms of AA. Really not a good fit. And I didn't know how to move out of that place. Like, I didn't know how to move away from that situation. And her, you know, 20 sponsees sent out an e-bite and showed up at my house and packed my stuff up in a box and took me to another place and unpacked me, and I was ready to just get under the covers. And my sponsor had collected the super extra weird sponsee who had, like, red and white striped hair. And on the very first sponsee meeting that she came to, she brought adult novelties as, like, gifts for all the other sponsors. Like, I was a soccer mom driving a minivan. Like, who is this girl? And my sponsor kept insisting that we were just the same. We were just the same. I wanted nothing to do with her, but we were just the same. And what she taught me was to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We got in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous at the emotional age that I was. So if I started drinking at the age of 12 and I had 2 years of sober, I was 15 or 16 when we got into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what we did was we just started going to young people in AA, and we went to bingo nights and dances and conventions and, you know, Icky Paw in New York, and we just, like, had so much fun in AA, and I started to find the joy that I needed to find, and a safe place to be, you know, and a place to be where I could actually share my experience, strength, and hope with people that that I understood. If I understood kids who didn't feel great about themselves, that didn't feel like life was worth it, that didn't feel like anything got better than when you were wasted or out there, you know, having fun. And that's where I needed to be, like, so desperately. And she's been my best. I pray for her tonight. She's having some stomach problems. Otherwise, she'd be here with me because that's what we do. We show up for each other all the time. She'd probably tell you my story. That's what I do. I have besties and sober sisters and brothers, and I have a home group, which is right now the Pacific group. I have people that I'm accountable to. I have people that I sponsor, that I answer the phone when they call. I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor, who I call regularly on a weekly basis and meet with on a monthly basis. And all of these things keep me sober because my thinking problem isn't gone. Like, I can fall right back into the thinking problem I had when I was 16 years old in a heartbeat, you know? Like, I can talk myself back into the fact that it's not okay. You know, life has been so freaking crazy this last year, like, so freaking crazy. But the year before that, I had an actual breast cancer issue where I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I had to walk through that. And I had to look at what would have life been like had I not been here anymore. So for this year, it's been about thanking God that I'm still here and what can I do to keep myself and everybody around me safe. And, you know, that's a lot more of AA. So I'm just so impressed. If you are here and you're new, I'm so incredibly impressed with you that you are here on Zoom staying sober. Like, just I have so much awe and admiration for you that you are here and trying in a pandemic, and you know that we were able as a fellowship to, you know, knock it out of the park and become this Zoom fellowship where we're available, you know, by camera. And just know that, you know, when this is all over, you're going to get so many hugs when you walk into the room, Doc Hawk Anonymous, because if we were huggers before the pandemic, I just cannot not even imagine what it's going to be like after the pandemic. So just know you're getting virtual love all the time and that it's there for you. And the other thing I want to say is, if you're new, the most heavy piece of equipment you're ever going to touch is a telephone. Pick it up and use it. You're giving a gift to another alcoholic if you ask for help. Like, I thought fiercely independent was like what it was at, but really what it is asking for help and letting another alcoholic be of service. That's what we're here for. That's how we stay out of ourselves, is to do things for other people. So when you feel like that phone is too heavy, pick it up and do it anyways, because you're giving us a gift when you call us. And, you know, one of my favorite one of the things that I think of for Alcoholics Anonymous is that it gave me hope. And for me, the acronym for HOPE is Hold On, Pain Ends. A feeling is not a fact. A feeling will not last forever. And that pain will go away. This too shall pass, right? So reach out, grab the hand of another alcoholic, get through it, and stay sober one day, one moment, one telephone call at a time. And I'm just really super happy to be here and grateful that you all were here to listen to me. And I think that's all I've got. So, thanks.